We go back in time to Renaissance Italy to meet one of humanity's most influential minds. From SDPB, today is Monday, November 18th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, two of the directors of the PBS documentary Leonardo da Vinci join us. The Ken Burns film premieres tonight and tomorrow. Sarah Burns and David McMahon will take us into da Vinci's life and legacy in art and science. Then we'll meet one of South Dakota's own Renaissance artists. Dick Termas uses math and science as his bedrock when creating termospheres. We will play with geometry as we step inside his vision. Plus, a children's book written by a local restaurant owner explores indigenous traditions and food systems. Lawrence West is later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's talk about one of humankind's most curious and famously innovative minds, Leonardo da Vinci. He shaped the 15th century, and he influences us immeasurably today. Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, and David McMahon have a new documentary coming to SDPB. It explores da Vinci through his paintings, drawings, and writings. Directors Sarah Burns and David McMahon preview the next film.
It is a unique subject for us in that there wasn't the wealth of visual material that we often have when we tackle a new topic. So, for example, with Muhammad Ali, there were many thousands of photographs and miles of film footage of him on camera speaking. And in this case, there was an absence, really, of any material from his time of him. A handful of likenesses, some of which we can definitely determine is a likeness of him, and in some cases, we're not 100% sure. So we saw that at first as a challenge, but eventually and quickly as an opportunity for us to create a new kind of visual language for our movie. And so we're always seeking beauty, no matter what it is. We want timeless beauty, whether it's in the landscapes we're filming or the footage we're finding. But in this case, the bar was at a particular spot because it is Leonardo da Vinci. But so instead of using the archives, we were able to go out and film our own cinematography of the Italian landscapes. We were able to find material from the 20th century archival footage that spoke to something that he had drawn or some project that he was working on. And then we were able to use the notebooks themselves that he left behind. And that's something like 6,000 pages that contain 100,000 different preparatory studies, sketches, geometric proofs, in some cases grocery lists. And we could use all of that as well. And then we decided that if we split the screen and put several of these things on screen at one time, that we could get people a little closer to understanding what was going on in his head. And we could erase some of the boundaries between the disciplines, or as we would think of them, disciplines, art, science, math, and see it all as kind of lateral, because he blurred the lines between those things. He combined all those things in his work. And so by splitting the screen, we could do several things at once that would get people closer to understanding his process. And then we would be able to show a wealth of the works that he had left behind. And as you were suggesting before, elevate the beauty of everything that he had left behind.
Yeah, there's nature photography that is, I thought, groundbreaking. And then did you find artisans, you know, people to stand in and draw something, the hands, the making of the pigment, the filling of the shells with the painting materials? Sarah, tell me a little bit about some of the characters and the scene setting and the context that shows up that you really had to create from scratch.
Yeah, we really wanted to give our audience a sense of the materials that he would have been using, which is so different, you know, painting on a wood panel. And as you said, you know, grinding pigments to make paint, a sense of what the kind of materials that Leonardo would have been handling and in some cases inventing, right? Different ways of creating paints, mixing paints that he had. And so we found a number of different people to help us with that. We found an artist in Florence who knew a lot, also sort of an art historian, and knew a lot about these materials from the period. And he created these works. It's his hand that you see painting and drawing in the film. And he created these works, sort of partially finished versions of Leonardo works that we could film up very close to give a sense of what his style was to see his hand in there. But interestingly, Leonardo, who was left-handed, of course, and our artist, Gleb, was not left-handed. And so everything that he made a mirror image of the artwork, and then we filmed him using his right hand and flipped everything after the fact. We also found a gentleman in Italy who is sort of an expert in writing in Leonardo's handwriting in the mirror script. Leonardo wrote everything backwards in mirror script so as not to smudge the ink on the page. And so this man has trained himself to write in that way. And so we filmed him doing the writing. We also found, in order to demonstrate kind of the context in which Leonardo was trained, the artisans of Florence, the workshop of Andrea del Verrocchio, where he was an apprentice and learned all of these skills, painting, but also, wood carving and jewelry making and sculpting and everything. We found all of these artisans still working in Florence today, in some cases using techniques and tools that are not that different from what they would have used in Verrocchio's Bottega 500 years ago. And so we filmed those people carving wood frames and, putting gold leaf on them or making gold jewelry, and those fairly antique tools that they were using, which was a really cool thing to discover that Florence still has this incredible tradition of artisans and craftsmen.
The script, of course, is also beautiful, and you've won awards for documentary script making. What makes a good documentary script?
That's a great question.
That's a great question. I think in this case, we populated our script with, in our movie, with interviewees who we thought would give a broad perspective on Leonardo's life and times. And so, yes, we sought out biographers, and they were great on camera. Yes, we sought out art historians who could explain what it was he was doing in his work. But we also found a heart surgeon who was interested in his anatomical and physiological studies. We found a playwright who had explored the depths of those notebooks and was trying to make sense of who he was. An engineer who had looked at all these innovations that he had sketched, and tried to find out, was this a real experiment that he was running over here, or was it just a thought experiment? We spoke to the filmmaker Guillermo del Toro, who had published his own set of notebooks that were related to his filmmaking projects, and revealed that in his process, he does little sketches of creatures, fantastical creatures that he might like to put in his films, and then he writes about them in a particular way. And if you put his notebooks and Leonardo's notebooks side by side, you see that he was definitely inspired by Leonardo's notebooks. And so the base for our script was in part gathering this ensemble cast of people who were really inspired by Leonardo and had really thoughtful things to say about them. Leonardo is a subject that's been researched deeply. The historical record is fairly thin. We, in writing the parts of it for our narrator, we're going to rely on the work that had already been done by others. So we read everything. We spent a lot of time in Italy, but we did not go combing through the archives, seeking something in the margins that would tell us of some document that would tell us something new about Leonardo. We instead relied on the incredible body of research that's already been done. And then we shaped a narrative that was going to follow his personal journey from birth to death. And so when you combine all those elements, and then we have the visual language that we talked about earlier, and then an original score. Often we populate our films with popular music from the times of our subject, but in this case, we hired Caroline Shaw to create an original score using a vocal ensemble, a percussion ensemble, and a string quartet, when she did a beautiful job of creating music that we thought really connected to Leonardo. And all of these layers add up to what we hope is a compelling 4 hours that helps people understand Leonardo and his thinking and his times.
I want to get in more to that, especially his early life, because I found that so compelling. What do your notebooks look like then? As you're putting all of this together, what do your notebooks look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think we gather information, as Dave was saying, in lots of different ways. And so our process is from the very beginning, this one of just like trying to gather as much as we can. And so that means reading all of these art historians and the research that's been done. And, you know, we take notes in all different kinds of ways. I can't say that we have notebooks nearly as interesting or beautiful as Leonardo's or Guillermo's. But, you know, we take those notes usually just on the computer, though notebooks too sometimes. I don't think anyone would be very interested to see them though. But it really is, as Dave said, like all of these different pieces. It's thinking about the visuals at the same time as we're thinking about the story, the same time as we're thinking about who else we want to talk to. So all of those things are happening kind of in unison. And for us also, we moved to Italy for a year while working on this so that we could do all of that there also. Talking to people there who are Leonardo experts, just being in the place. I mean, Florence, like with the artisans, there's a lot there that feels like, in many ways, the buildings are the same. You know, you can walk in Leonardo's footsteps in some ways, you know, step into the churches and see this extraordinary Renaissance art everywhere. And then also explore the country and think about the landscapes that he explored. He, you know, climbs up in the mountains to think about why there are fossils up in the mountaintops of sea creatures and why the mountains in the distance look different from the ones up close. And so we wanted to be in those spaces both to film, but also to just experience them. It's part of our research process.
Yeah, if I might add, we did for the visual piece of this have a kind of look board or mood board situation where we would draw from other films, or we had liked the visual language or the pacing of them, or this found material that kind of spoke to, hundreds of years later, something that Leonardo is working on. So footage of a human-powered flying contraption from the 1970s, or an Archimedes screw that peasant farmers in early 20th century France were using to draw water from. These are all things that you could find Leonardo exploring in his notebooks, a very early version, maybe perhaps in some cases an original version, or he's riffing on something that he had looked at or read about from 18 centuries earlier, in this case, say, Archimedes or Aristotle or Galen. So he's drawing from that ancient wisdom, and then he's working all this out. And so visually, we gathered as much of this as we could, and we put it in various sort of look boards to inspire what we thought the visual grammar of the film should be. And that was fun. We have a great team that we work with, and as Sarah was saying, we set up a kind of research library. But unlike any other film, we experimented very early on with all of what we had gathered and played around with. Could we split the screen? Can we put X-rays of the lungs against one of his profound drawings, anatomical drawings of a human chest, in layers, exterior, interior. Is there something in nature that he found, that he wrote about and explored, that also reflects this focus? And we could put that in front of us and lay it all out and kind of see then how it fit into a moment in our film.
It's mind-blowing what he did and what you've done and how those come together and inspire us today and clearly inspire all these people who have spent so many hours and years of their lives devoted to finding those, pieces of documentation that no one had seen before. By way of example, you have so many examples in the film, but take something like The Last Supper, and other artists had painted this image before, and Leonardo is not, that we're aware of, a strong Christian. It's not like he is a believer in this tradition per se. However, he does something that no one else had done before with this painting in this hidden monastery, like lunchroom, to help explain people so that they can understand what all is in this film. What did he do that was so remarkable in that it stays with us today?
Yeah, I think it is a really great example of what was so special and unique about Leonardo. I think because that was an incredibly common work. And as you said, it's not clear that he was, I mean, I think he believed in God, but he was not, devoted to the church, certainly, the way people of his time were necessarily. I think he had an instinct to challenge authority. So he was interested, as Dave was saying, in, the wisdom of the ancients, and he certainly knew the Bible and was familiar with all of these stories that he frequently painted, as his peers did. But he was also always going to question that. He was going to sort of push back and think about it in his own way. And I think for him, he was interested in nature most of all. And that includes the human body and the human form and how the body works and how people think. And so the thing in a painting, I think when he was painting a person, the thing most important to him was conveying, as he said, the intentions of the mind. He wants to think about how do you show in this two-dimensional form in a painting that shows the exterior of a person, what's going on inside them, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and how can you portray that in a painting? That is, I think, not what painters of his time were necessarily all thinking about. And so he takes something like The Last Supper, and he, you know, which, as we say in the film, you know, this is a very common subject, but it was frequently painted as this kind of quiet scene. Everyone's just sitting there at this table, and, you know, all the figures are represented, but they're kind of solitary and quiet, sedate scenes. And he goes, he reads the story, and he goes, what would these people have been thinking, and how would they have been reacting to this very dramatic moment of Jesus announcing that one of these disciples is going to betray him? And so he, you know, Leonardo would go out in the piazzas and sketch people, just observe them from afar and sketch people talking and arguing, and how would they gesture and what are their facial expressions look like. He dissected cadavers to understand the interior of the body, all towards being able to portray the scene in this way that is so much more dynamic and alive and kind of in motion. It feels like it's several seconds of this moment kind of unfolding, and everyone is reacting in different ways to this announcement. And you see in the hand gestures and the facial expressions, all of this, and it's just an entirely different version of this scene that really puts you in that moment in a different way. And I think it's a great example of what Leonardo was interested in, pushing the boundaries of the art form beyond what anyone else was doing with it.
I love that. If someone's thinking something, how would they react? How does that show up in their hands, in their eyebrows? Yeah. And yeah. Then how do I draw that in a way that translates it to a person? How does line and texture and form come together to make me feel, then the viewer feels that as well? And people have been meditating on this for centuries.
Yeah, and he's also thinking about it in terms of technique also, right? Like how he wants to make it feel three-dimensional, right? And create using light and shadow. He wants to make these forms feel like they exist in space and not just on this two-dimensional, you know, panel or wall. And so with The Last Supper, it's one of the unfortunate things about it is that it's not in great shape. Right. It began flaking off the wall within Leonardo's lifetime because he had developed this new technique in order to better do that, create that sense of three-dimensionality that you can't really do with traditional fresco technique. Unfortunately, it wasn't very long lasting.
Yeah. As filmmakers, what do you take away from, you know, Jackie Robinson, or what do you take away from Leonardo da Vinci? When you move on to your next project, what will you take away from this, the year that you spent in Italy, the time that you spent making this work, the time that you spent talking about it and getting feedback from viewers? What carries with you as a filmmaking duo?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like these are subjects that we're familiar with. We know Jackie Robinson, we know Muhammad Ali, we know Leonardo da Vinci. And so I think the challenge is that, you know, we want to find new scholarship, we want to find new perspectives, and we want to deepen people's sense of who they are. And we have this luxury in working with Ken and public television to have these long timelines where we can perhaps go deeper than other filmmakers have been able to, spend more time on it, continue a process from beginning of end of learning. We never stop trying to find new perspectives or new people who have come up with new ideas about who our subject it was. And then another thing is that the times change. And so a Jackie Robinson portrayed in 1990 may feel differently against that backdrop than a Jackie Robinson portrayed in 2020. I mean, we're advancing, we're becoming wiser, we're asking better questions, and all of that combined with new scholarship means that these people do need to be reconsidered. And so I think we take the lessons of each of them, we throw ourselves into this attempt to understand this person and communicate what we've learned to our audience, and then we carry that along. And so in the case of a Leonardo da Vinci, where we didn't have the depths of the historical record that we might have had with Muhammad Ali. We were seeking something a little different, something maybe a little more ecstatic and emotional. And so we approached it in a way where visually we wanted to communicate a lot about him. And so maybe as we approach our next subject, we've carried along from our process of Leonardo a different way of thinking about how to approach our subject visually. And so I think each film has certain demands, certain challenges, certain opportunities. And so we try to do the best job that we can to get it right. And then we move to the next one, which presents new demands, new possibilities, new opportunities, new challenges. And so we carry them all with us, but they each taught us something different.
Leonardo da Vinci premieres on SDPB and on the PBS app November 18th. The documentary was made by Ken Burns, along with our guests, Sarah Burns and David McMahon. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the break, you heard our conversation with the filmmakers behind PBS's Leonardo da Vinci. Again, that two-part documentary premieres tonight and tomorrow. Next, we're bringing you an interview with South Dakota's own Leonardo da Vinci. Dick Termas is a Black Hills artist renowned for the unique three-dimensional ways he depicts space and time. His spherical paintings combine art and mathematics in breathtaking ways. Here is our conversation from October. We talked with him ahead of an event he was part of at South Dakota School of Mines.
Yeah, I think the math and science maybe came along with the jump because I wanted to capture a complete world. So when I look back upon it anyway, when you're doing it, you don't really realize a lot of times where your mind is taking you. But I actually was interested in getting the whole picture instead of a small little canvas on the wall. I took the frame away and let that picture continue up above and around you and underneath you. If you can imagine every painting that you've looked at, can you imagine that as a world? And they've just taken one little piece out of it. That's what I wanted to do and I've been doing. So that's what's really cool about this is that the sphere captures that whole environment, and then this new virtual reality actually puts you inside the sphere, so you really get to see the whole, the north, south, east, west, up and down around you environment. So it's really a neat new step.
When did you start working with virtual reality?
Well, you know, it's actually my niece and nephew are the ones that jumped into that, and then they said, come look at this. This is what your stuff can do. It's work that's growing off of my work, which is very cool because I've always felt like good artwork should be able to be built uponable, you know, like other people can actually jump on the bandwagon and build it into something even more so than what you started with. It actually is a step forward and a step backwards because when I do the sphere, I imagine I'm painting a complete world on the outside of the sphere. And I keep telling people this, and it's like I have north on one side, south on the other, east, west, up and down. It's always been inside out, you might say, until the virtual reality can put you inside the sphere and see what it actually looks like. Because people look at it and they just start giggling. They say, this is what you've been talking about all these years. And I find that really quite funny.
So when you first put on the virtual reality gear and saw what could happen, was it what you had already been seeing inside your mind?
Right, exactly, exactly. It is what I was thinking, but it's still quite a treat for me to get inside of them and look at what all of this world looks like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
From inside. And that's what we're going to be doing at School of Mines, is having that show tied in with the Da Vinci document, a piece of it, I think, that's going to be going too. And we're going to try and show how my kind of thinking is similar to how Da Vinci thought. I mean, he invented the helicopter before the helicopter. He was playing around with airplanes before we have airplanes. He was like a surgeon before surgeons did surgery. He knew what was inside the body, you know. He investigated all that stuff. And then later, something happens that actually creates a real airplane. The Wright brothers come along, you know, and all of that. But he kind of broke the ice in a lot of different directions. And so it's neat to tie in with him like this.
And people have been building on to so much of what he said for centuries.
Yeah, oh my, yes. And then he was just a great artist too. I mean, he did the Mona Lisa, my goodness, you know. I mean, how could you beat that?
I don't know that you can. The innovation, the ability, the willingness, the desire, and the ability to see things that other people haven't seen yet, but also curiosity. What's the role of curiosity in your art career and in your art making?
You know, every piece I do, I can't just do the piece. I have to have learned something from it. When people come into my gallery, they look at so many different directions. That's because I'm actually searching, trying to find something new that the sphere can talk about. I was very lucky to hit on the sphere because it opens your mind to a whole different category of ideas that aren't possible on the flat surface. I'm just driven by trying to figure out, well, what all can you say when you work with a spherical canvas? Because it's a total picture canvas, but it's also all the three-dimensional geometries. So I've gotten into all the geometries that fit on a sphere too, all the platonic solid, because they also help me with ideas. I'm working on a new commission of the Black Hills right now and the Native people. Basically, the two of those kind of interwoven. And I'm playing with a polyhedron structure that has a three, four, five system to it. It's called a rhombic icosahedron. I love that name. It took me a while to be able to say that. A rhombic icosahedron, you know?
Nice.
So I'm trying to figure out how that connects with our Native people and with Black Hills, and how structure like that can also be a good structure to interweave with the Black Hills and the Native people here. And I'm trying to start it before Custer came along. And so it's everything ahead of that. I don't want to get into all the wars and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be kind of fun, but it's interesting how you can try and tie mathematics and geometry in with a concept like that. And by doing that, it actually gives me back lots of new, fresh ideas by forcing myself to fit these two things together.
Yeah, I think that is just so a master class for every artist, no matter what field you're in, really everybody, but in the arts, like if you're not learning something from the piece that you're doing, maybe you should be doing a different piece. Like, what is the next thing that you can learn? On this show, I learn so much. It's not just a conversation, it's a learning opportunity for everyone who's in conversation with us right now. And I just love that. I think that's so challenging and inspiring and delightful. It makes being alive just really great, doesn't
It really
it?
does. Yes, it does. It makes it a lot more fun. I can't believe people that can stick with the same thing day after day after day. I just am not that type of person. I just have to try and explore new things and hit on new ideas that I've got a few ideas that I keep going, why aren't people excited about this? A certain, you know, some of these things I'm bringing to the show along the side are other invention kind of ideas that I want people to play with and see if they get excited about it because they excite me a lot. I just want to see how it touches other people.
Is there anything from your childhood that you think this is when I remember that spark of curiosity being lit?
It's a good question. I'm not sure if I can, you know, I'm sure it was always there, and I've always been curious about lots of stuff. I think it took me a while to realize that I wanted to end up in the arts. The arts, the advantage of the arts is that it opens the door, and there isn't like a rules that go with the arts. You create your own rules as you go along, and if if they're sort of right, people say, oh yeah, that's good, and that's in the arts, you know. But if you're in science and math, you've got to do stuff that fits with what's already been done. In the arts, you're allowed to play with math, play with science, and not follow their rules. And then sometimes by just playing with it, you come up with stuff they wouldn't have thought of. It's interesting, because it just, when you have a free mind to think about stuff, it's a lot different than when you have to follow 18 books ahead of you and you have to do the next chapter, and you kind of go, I don't want to read these 18 books. I just want to do the new chapter. Then that's what the arts are good for. They're really fun that way, that you can really play with your mind. I've often thought that's what my job has been, is just being able to play with my mind my whole life. And it's just, what an honor it is to not have a lot of the other worries that people have. I've been lucky because been able to make enough of a living to be able to have a free life, to be able to think what I wanted to think about. What a super life that is when you get to do that.
And how lucky the rest of us are to get to be part of it, because you invite other people in to that. We're in the art gallery with the virtual reality goggles on, seeing a hint at what you see. We're in the space with you. You teach art, you bring other people along to all that innovation. You spend a lot of time giving us that in return, and we're grateful for that.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm glad you said that. That's very nice. I appreciate it.
How much time a day do you just spend thinking or tinkering?
Well, my thinking is, I find I think better as I'm drawing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't just think. I have to have an idea and be playing with it in drawing form. And it seems like the drawing and the painting actually help me come up with the ideas. When I'm just thinking about how am I going to like this piece, I've been thinking and thinking about how can I do a piece of the Black Hills that's different than anything I've done, that plays with the native people, that's different than anything I've done. And then until I actually start putting it down and start playing with it, then all of a sudden I go, oh yeah, this is what I should do. Yeah. This is how these can fit. So the ideas really come from the working the media along, you know, keeping that going.
So you have to trust that process and just enjoy it and let it unfold.
Right, yes, indeed.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. As we've covered all hour, art can sometimes convey the beauty of scientific concepts. That was Leonardo da Vinci's specialty and what artists like Dick Turmis do to this day. Next, let's focus on art as an educational tool. Lawrence West is founder of Wetechable, and he seeks to pass down traditional knowledge in his children's book. First We Harvest, Then We Cook explores Lakota food systems on the prairie.
The journey to becoming an author is hazy, very hazy. But so in 2015, I got a job as a restaurant manager, and I kind of like immersed myself in it and kind of fell in love with the restaurant industry. But obviously with the lack of representation out there for our dialect of food, just being the over go-getter that I am, it drove me to start a food truck. So I opened the food truck, and things kind of progressed from there to other restaurants and more food trucks. And
so what did you love about the industry? Like, what was lighting you up about being in the industry and just being around people doing that work?
Exactly that, the people, the conversation, you know, the education aspect of it. And it's like, if you see someone on the street and you might be afraid to approach them, or that, you know, you might think they're, you know, dangerous or standoffish or whatever insecurities that you have, but over a plate of food, those insecurities don't exist, because you don't have time to be worrying about ill intention or whatever. You're just enjoying great food. I mean, you get to learn so much because it makes people open up. It helps them relax. And honestly, it's the food aspect. I mean, the conversation aspect that the food brings.
Yeah. Everybody comes to the table.
Yeah.
At some point.
Everyone. And it doesn't matter, you know.
You know, I could say did you grow up writing? But did you grow up eating? And we all say yes.
Yes.
We all grew up eating. And you grew up in the kitchen sometimes, too. Tell me a little bit about that. How'd you learn about food?
Growing up, it's just in the Native American tradition to, potluck. That's how we did it. And being younger and growing up in South Dakota, that culture was a lot more prevalent back in the day. For the family gathering, we used to do it in parks. We used to do it in your front yard, It just used to be a lot more family. And with family comes food, tradition, your recipes, you're taught this by your aunt or showed that by your grandma or inspired by your mom.
All right. So you decide at some point that you want to put some of what into this rather beautiful little book.
Thank you.
First we harvest, then we cook. The harvest is really important. Going back to the source of the food, where does our food come from? It's not first we shop or let's go take a trip to the grocery store. It's first we harvest and then we cook. Where did you begin with writing this and thinking about the journey that you wanted to take readers on?
Obviously, spreading the word of my people in particular. A lot of America blandly washes Native American into an individual singular culture, and it's not that at all. So yes, there's books out there and there's things that talk about, the three sisters and the other things that are supposed to be the Native American food supply chain, but it's so vast. The only reason that those things are still talked about is because that's what people can still grow today. But the things that we're introducing are things that are natural, things that you can't grow. I can't grow them. They don't do well in captive areas. They're grown on the prairie. They're natural. You can only get them from the prairie.
Yeah. So tell people what some of these things are.
The things that I chose to highlight, obviously, are a couple of things that I enjoy cooking with. But I also, these are my favorite flavors, Timsila. The prairie turnip, from the very moment that you take it from its dry state and you put it into warm water, the oils just start seeping into the water and it lets off this really lavender, wild flower. And it takes up the whole room from just one little inch and a half pod,
Yeah.
And the texture, when you bite into it, it's just so silky. And it's and honestly, it's you're eating... the texture of it is wood, if you remember as a kid, if you were chewing on a stick, but it's really, really, really soft. I mean, the texture of it is a solid, know, but the flavor and the meltiness of it is something that you just have to taste.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time where you made the connection between that taste and what it was? Did someone teach you how to harvest it? Did you find it somewhere in the wild?
So I first had it in a soup, at a wake when I was younger, because, Taniga is the traditional soup that generally Timsila is used in. Some people call the soup Timsila, but it's not, it's called Taniga.
Okay.
And it's made with Timsila and white hominy, bison stomach, and then just sage and other natural, flavors and stuff. But so I probably learned what it was that I was eating when I was maybe 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go and self-educate at the time, but I just learned from my grandmother. My grandma Mert Howard taught me a ton of stuff about the old ways of the people,
Yeah. And is this the book is dedicated to Joyce and Mert. Who's Joyce?
Joyce is my other grandma. So Joyce, our last name is Bowker, but Joyce Pease is her married name. And Mert Howard are sisters, and they're my grandmothers.
Yeah. So yes. Dedicated to the grandmas.
Yes.
I love that. All right. So Timsila, what, and choke cherries.
Choke cherries. Oh, my God.
Tell me about choke cherries. Yeah.
So... out of choke cherries, and it mentions in there wild plums, but essentially they're harvested the same exact way.
Okay.
I favor wild plums over choke cherries because I don't, choke cherries have like, they're like a bitter cherry taste. And I mean, okay. They taste like I eat it and I enjoy it. But if we're talking about like going out and harvesting, I'm going to harvest a wild plum over the choke cherry every time, just because it's got like that sweeter snap. And it, mm-hmm. and you can taste like there's no citric acid. Like it's not like a processed food, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, so choke cherries and wild plums essentially grow on bushes and short bushes and short trees. They ripen late July, early August, and they're harvested the same way. You just go out and you shake your bush and your berries fall down, and they're used for anything. Like back in the day, choke cherries were used to like dye quills or like dye horsehair for headdresses and different things. But also mostly like when you get the choke cherries, you have to process them instantly because they don't hold because they're such a small berry.
Okay.
There's nothing to decompose. So you harvest the berries, you grind them instantly, and you separate the seeds, and then you make the 3-inch pucks and you freeze them. And then when you want choke cherries, and this is how they were made back in the day, but they weren't frozen back in the day. They would sun dry them, and then they would keep them in that state until they were ready to cook them in preserve, or you know.
Yeah.
But we make them and keep them in the freezer.
In sage.
Sage. Absolutely. Mm. Sage. Mm. So sage has got to be one of my favorite things. And obviously I wanted to put that in the first book because that's pertinent to the people, you know, like sage is probably one of the most prominent things. And that holds true, you know, in the teachings and the tellings and stuff for what we use it for. And I mean, it's used for one number of things, any number of things from ceremony to cooking to just having, you know, like it's sort of like a security blanket, like a protection thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. And harvesting it, not to the base.
Yeah, not to the
base. This idea of harvesting responsibly, yeah?
Yeah, so like the Timsila, you want to dig underground and you want to get the bulb because that's exactly what the Timsila is the bulb that produces the plant. But mm-hmm. say like when you're harvesting sage, if you touch the roots, it's dead. It's just not going to grow back. And it's kind of like, I wouldn't say it's extinct, but it's getting there. And a lot of people, and this is the thing, and this is probably the most important message and the reason why I started writing first we harvest and then we cook books, is because people misconstrue conventional farming with the Native American food supply chain. Fresh food and Native American food supply chain are two totally different things, okay? So the construct of colonialism was to destroy the Native American food supply chain. Okay, so conventional farming was invented by a specific group of people, right? And those specific group of people's intentions were to destroy or to decimate or to, you know, to wipe out the Native American food supply chain. So the things that are in the pesticides and things that they say are treating the land, the things that they're treating or killing is the Native American food supply chain. The things that modern farming constitute as weeds, we ate that traditionally, like 9 out of 10 of the plants. Hmm. So, and that's the thing is like people say farm fresh or farmer's market. And yes, I love it. I buy all of my food in my restaurant from local farmers. I go and source it from them. But local farming, modern farming, farming in its entire construct was designed and created to destroy the Native American food supply chain because the people that invented farming didn't see our food as food. They didn't eat it. It wasn't food to them. They wanted to get that out of the way so they can till the land, plant their corn, plant their beans, plant their squash, whatever it is that they wanted to plant there, you know, their cucumbers, cherries, tomatoes, whatever. You know,
what can be reclaimed through education and through practice of cooking. Yeah.
That's a good question. Honestly, the education factor of it and my position of it is to educate my people, you know, because it's like a lot of people are like, oh, as Native Americans, we need to educate other people. Other people need to be, you know this information. In all actuality, it's like, yeah, other people should know this information, but after years of assimilation and meth abuse and reservation and you know, drug use, you know, the children that are should know this information nowadays don't have this information either. Mm-hmm. So it's not like one group or one type of people. We hope to restore this knowledge into the hands of the intended people that it's for, so that they can continue to harvest in this way, because these things are all over on the prairie down there, you know, but you don't identify them. You know, people will walk over them to go smoke weed by the lake, or, you know, go, you know, and it's like, stop and look at them, you know, dig them up. And like off topic, like at my house, I make a blend of oil when I cook my fry bread, and it's 0% trans fat, like the whole nine yards, right? But at my home, I have cups of like all of the things that are processed down to make my oils, and I, you know, I touch them and I smell them and I taste them, and mm-hmm. and without using your five senses and going out and self-educating and immersing in this knowledge that's being passed down, like, it's just going to die. It's going to go away. And I don't want that to happen.
Yeah. Tell me about the illustrator of the book.
Oh, my God.
Ella Ratliff.
I really honestly just want you to reach out to her. And because we didn't get to work together per se. Like, she created Chepa, the logo. I reached out to her when I was changing from the food truck to a restaurant, and I said, hey, I need something to represent my change. I was like, but also at the end of the day, I was like, Wateachable is not dying. I was like, in 20 years, I'll have 2,000 restaurants all over the country. I was like, so why not just get in the game now? And I was like, this is what I want. And she sent Chepa back, and I was like, dope, awesome. Yes, absolutely, you know? And then when I was writing the book, I had just kind of mentioned it to her, and I said, hey, would you be interested in helping me with this children's book? I was like, it's something that I've wanted to do. I was like, I'm not an author. I was like, I'm not an educator. I was like, I just have this knowledge. And instead of, you know, telling each individual person, I just want to put it out there so that people can come and go from it. I was like, but I want it to be more than just a bland book, mm-hmm. you know, like, and after I seen the illustrations, I was like, my words don't matter. Like, I literally can take my words out and just give you this book. And it's like,
it's beautiful.
Yeah. You would still kind of understand, you know, from the pictures, what's going on in there. And I don't know where her headspace was at, but she did her thing on them illustrations. I don't know. And we've never actually spoke about it.
Yeah.
I'm just grateful that I was able to partner with her on this. And I mean, I would honestly love to know her thoughts.
That's first-time author and restaurateur Lawrence West. His children's book is called First We Harvest, Then We Cook. It's available online or at your local library. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, author Dave Eggers returns to Rapid City. He came at first to find out why his book had been scheduled for destruction by the Rapid City School District. What he discovered was a community of readers. We'll talk about the documentary, To Be Destroyed. From all of us at STPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.